Well, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. Questions about Russia and his campaign followed him across the Atlantic as President Trump took questions during a joint press briefing in Paris with French President Emmanuel Macron. Trump was again asked about a meeting between a Russian attorney and his eldest son.
But nothing happened from the meeting. Zero happened from the meeting. And honestly, I think the press made a very big deal over something that really a lot of people would do.
Macron was also asked about his feelings on diplomacy with Russia.
We have a lot of disagreements. We have a lot of discrepancies, obviously, with Russia. But in the current environment, especially in the Middle East, it's a necessity to work together, to exchange information, to share disagreements, and to try to build solutions.
Trump also dealt with French concerns about his decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, as the two leaders tried to focus on finding common ground on areas like Syria and counterterrorism. China's best-known human rights prisoner, Liu Xiaobo, died Thursday at the age of 61 following a high-profile battle with liver cancer that made his death controversial as it was his life. Liu, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate who spent his last 8 years as a prisoner of conscience, passed away at a hospital in Shenyang, China, where he'd been moved from his prison cell in the final stage of his illness.
When he was given this, 11-year sentence at the time, it was absolutely outrageous. And I think that many people are just feel a sense of grief, of course, at his loss, but also outrage that he should have been in prison to begin with. And unfortunately, what we've seen over the last few years is that the trends towards human rights have only gotten worse.
This is VOA. The U.S. State Department is asking all nations to provide extensive data about their citizens wishing to travel to the United States to help U.S. officials decide whether those citizens constitute a terrorist threat. Reuters News Service quoted a diplomatic cable Thursday that says it was sent a day earlier to all U.S. diplomatic posts. While the fight to defeat Islamic State militants makes gains, most recently with the Iraqi government's liberation of Mosul, the United States and its partners are intensifying global pressure against the terrorists and rallying support for more resources for post-conflict stabilization efforts. Brett McGurk, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Coalition Against Islamic State Militants, told reporters Thursday the situation in Syria is much more challenging.
I was in Syria a couple weeks ago as the Raqqa campaign gets underway. Raqqa and Syria is much more complicated than Iraq, but fairly similar model, working by, with, and through partners and preparing the ground for basic humanitarian and stabilization relief efforts.
Some experts argue that the defeat of Islamic State will not end U.S. involvement in Middle East conflicts. Such a development may, in fact, lead to increased American engagement. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson left Qatar Thursday with little apparent progress in his shuttle diplomacy aimed at ending Doha's diplomatic standoff with four Arab countries. State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert said Thursday that Tillerson shuttled to and from meetings in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait in an effort to broker an end to the dispute.
This all has been a long time coming. You know that these disputes are not brand new. Tensions in the past have been fairly raw, so it's going to take some time to get these parties together. Just last week, we characterized this as possibly at an impasse. So the mere fact that the secretary's been there talking to both sides of this and encouraging them to sit down and have a conversation, I would see as subtle progress.
The Saudi-led group broke off diplomatic ties with Qatar last month, accusing Doha of funding terrorism and being close to rival Iran. Qatar has rejected the accusations. Members of the marine community in the U.S. and Canada say a Canadian fisherman who died freeing a whale from fishing gear was a longtime whale advocate who'd bridged gaps between fishing and conservation. Joe Howlett was killed Monday after freeing a North Atlantic right whale that had been entangled in fishing gear off New Brunswick. A close friend of his said the 59-year-old was hit by the whale just after it was cut free and started swimming away. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, July 14th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Sudan responds to delay in lifting U.S. sanctions.
We have never been discussing human rights with the American side. It has never been part of the five-track plan. This is why we feel that it has been pushed into the agenda in order to find excuses for not lifting the sanctions on time.
Ibrahim Gandour is Sudan's foreign minister. The UN envoy for Central Africa hails efforts to end Burundi's political crisis. South Sudan President Salva Kiir fires striking judges. And South Africa's Communist Party adds its voice to the demands for President Jacob Zuma to resign.
We are all convinced that unless President Jacob Zuma resigns, we are not going to be able to deal with the many problems associated with his leadership in government.
Alex Mashego is the spokesman for South Africa's Communist Party, and Zambia's opposition UPND says its jail leader has been transferred to a maximum security prison in defiance of a court order. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sudan has expressed disappointment over the U.S. government's decision to delay lifting sanctions permanently on Sudan. President Donald Trump signed a new order on Tuesday this week that extends the lifting of sanctions until October 12 this year. In response, President Omar al-Bashir issued a decree freezing the work of the committee responsible for all negotiations with the United States on normalization of bilateral relations until October 12 this year. But Foreign Minister Gandour says that Sudan will continue to cooperate with the United States, for example, on intelligence sharing. He said the sanctions have deprived the Sudanese people of getting medicine, technology, goods, and also not being able to transfer money. Mr. Gandour also said religious freedom, human rights, and other issues were never a part of the five-track process. He said the Trump administration introduced these new demands in order to justify delaying the lifting of the sanctions.
As you know, that we've been engaged with the U.S. administration for more than 2.5 years. With the current administration, we've been very much engaged and in vigorous talks on lifting the sanctions on the five-track plan on counterterrorism, combating the Lord's Resistance Army, peace in the region, peace in Sudan, humanitarian assistance. And according to the five-track plan, a decision was taken in January to lift temporarily the sanctions on the assumption that after 6 months or 180 days, it will be lifted. Unfortunately, we were disappointed, and in fact, the disappointment is in the Sudanese population at large, because they are who are suffering of the sanctions of not getting medicines, not getting technology, not able to transfer money, getting goods in an extra price, etc. So the disappointment is at large.
Mr. Minister, the Trump administration in postponing the decision to cancel the sanctions said that your government needs to do more on human rights, religious freedom. What is your government doing about these two issues and also political participation?
Religious freedoms, human rights, and other issues were not at all part of the five-track plan. It has just been pushed there in order to find a reasoning for postponement of the decision. Human rights here are highly reserved. This is a moral commitment, it's a religious commitment, and it's a commitment of a responsible government. We have never been discussing human rights with the American side. It has never been part of the five-track plan. This is why we feel that it has been pushed into the agenda in order to find excuses for not lifting the sanctions on time.
On political freedom, I know your government had been involved in political freedom.
The government just concluded a 2.5 years national dialogue in which 96 political parties participated. 48 armed groups were there. The Americans were witnessing all that. The international community, the UN, everybody, the EU, the AU, everybody praised that initiative.
Minister, I read, was it yesterday, that President Bashir had frozen all negotiations with the United States on the normalization of relations. Is that true or is that not true?
It is true. And on the other side, President Trump, in his decision, decided to freeze Article 11A and B, which is requesting reports from different institutions, including CIA, Foreign Affairs, USAID, and others, on the lifting of sanctions. And these are the actors with whom we are engaged. So President Bashir, in a show of protest and anger, decided to freeze that committee. But at the institutional level, we will continue in contact with the counterparts in the U.S. up to October and see what will be next.
The situation in Darfur, what's happening there?
I will just take you to the decision of the U.S. Security Council, a unanimous decision in which the U.S. representative was part. They decided that peace is now in Darfur, and so they had a unanimous decision to downsize the U.N. African Union Hybrid Force, UNIMID, by 50% during the coming 6 months. There are no rebel groups, no fighting right now in Darfur.
For Mr. Ganduo, thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
You are welcome. It's nice to talk to you too.
Ibrahim Ganduo, Sudan's foreign minister, he was speaking with us from the capital, Khartoum. South Africa's Communist Party, an alliance partner of the ruling African National Congress, ANC party, is demanding the resignation of President Jacob Zuma. The demand was also backed by two other alliance partners, the South African National Civic Organization, SANCO, and the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU. President Zuma has faced several criticisms, including corruption accusations he has strongly denied. The Communist Party says that there is need for a meeting of the alliance partners to, among other issues, find solutions to the country's problems, including unemployment, poverty, inequality, and violence. Alice Mesheho, spokesman for South Africa's Communist Party, tells viewers Peter Clarty that it is long overdue that President Zuma steps down.
We took the decision that it was time for President Jacob Zuma to resign. We communicated the decision to the African National Congress, which is the governing party. We are in alliance with the African National Congress, which means that when the ANC contests elections, it does so not only on behalf of its own members, but also on behalf of the South African Communist Party and the Progressive Trade Union Movement. We further said that the whole alliance has got to meet to discuss our decision that President Jacob Zuma must resign, because another alliance, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, also arrived at the same decision that it is time for President Jacob Zuma to resign. We are all convinced that unless President Jacob Zuma resigns, we are not going to be able to deal with the many problems associated with his leadership in government.
Does that mean failure of the ANC to meet your demand for the recall of President Zuma could potentially undermine the cooperation that the South African Communist Party has enjoyed with the ANC for years?
It has already undermined the cooperation. It is in the best interest of himself to resign. It is in the best interest of the ANC, of the whole of our cooperation. But most importantly, it is in the best interest of the people of South Africa.
So what's the next step for the South African Communist Party pertaining to the demand for the recall of President Jacob Zuma, of which the ANC has yet to take any firm decision on that? Because so far, the ANC has been backing President Jacob Zuma.
Our decision at this current moment is still that the president must resign. It is not that the ANC must recall him. If he does not resign, we will have to come back and say we took a decision that the president must resign. He has not resigned. What is the new decision that we need to take in the light of the fact that he has not resigned? And we will cross the bridge when we get there. At this moment, we have not yet taken a new decision on what must happen if he does not resign.
Gwede Mantashe, the general secretary of the ANC, said there are laid down regulations of which need to be followed, not that people just demand for his removal or perhaps his resignation that the party will accept. Why hasn't there been a meeting that you called to address this concern of yours demanding President Jacob Zuma's recall or resignation?
At this moment, we have not said he must be recalled. We have said that he must resign. We must have a discussion with him to resign. So we will deal with his recall if he does not resign.
Is there any talk between you and the other partners regarding the decision that, you know, the alliance partners concluded? Because other partners have come to the same conclusion as the South African Communist Party, demanding the resignation of President Jacob Zuma.
We have met. We are now saying all of us must meet. That meeting was postponed. We will for it when it is convened.
Has the ANC said any reasons why it's not met, the alliance partners, including the South African Communist Party?
The ANC has requested to meet with the alliance partners one by one, but we are saying let us meet together as one. A single alliance, because we are in alliance with one another. We will take things from there.
Alex Masheho is the spokesman for South Africa's Communist Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from Johannesburg. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, July 14th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Efforts to end the political crisis in Burundi picked up pace this week with the resumption of consultations. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
It has been a busy week for Burundi government and the opposition leaders, as consultations resumed in Bujumbura to end the political turmoil that was sparked in 2015. After the incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office, which the opposition say was unconstitutional, efforts have been made to put an end to the crisis through the regional mediated dialogue. François Fall, the UN Secretary General's Special Representative to Central Africa, said that the UN will continue the support towards peaceful resolution. He says he assured the President of the Republic of the continued support of the United Nations towards stability and development in the country. He said that he took time to hear him attentively and he is satisfied with the meeting. The United Nations Secretary General's Special Envoy, Michel Kafando, ended consultations yesterday in Bujumbura with the Burundi opposition leaders. After meeting President Pierre Nkurunziza last month and the former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa, after which he will present the report to the United Nations Security Council late this month. Agathon Rwasa is one of the opposition leaders in Burundi and the Deputy Speaker of the Parliament. He said that an inclusive dialogue is still a necessity to end the current turmoil.
President Mkapa would have said that his intention was to finish his process by June. While we do know, all of us, that the government showed no commitment to that process. And I can even say the government has shown enough eagerness to sabotage that process just because they pretended that they have got their own one.
Jörg Lauber is the chairman of the Burundi Configuration Peace Building Commission. After meeting President Pierre Nkurunziza, he called on all stakeholders to fully engage in an inclusive dialogue.
I was able to tell him first to thank him for the support and for the excellent cooperation we have, and then tell him a little bit about what the perception is by the international community of what the latest developments in Burundi. I told him about how the political dialogue on regional and national level is well perceived. Then we talked certainly about the socio-economic situation and what the configuration for peace building can do in order to support Burundi in this area.
The National Dialogue Commission that was formed by President Pierre Nkurunziza presented the final report to the parliament earlier this year. The report indicated that citizens had called on the Burundi government to amend the country's constitution, especially to scrap the term limits that will see the incumbent president contest in the 2020 general elections. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A South Sudanese legal expert says President Salva Kiir's decision to fire more than a dozen judges around the country who have been on strike for more than 2 months undermines the independence of the judiciary. The judges were demanding better pay and working conditions. They also want Chief Justice Chan Madut to step down. The strike has paralyzed South Sudan's overstretched and cash-strapped judicial system, leaving the courts unable to hear hundreds of cases. Wake Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuei told the South Sudan in Focus the judges were sacked by presidential order in an announcement read on South Sudan Broadcasting Television last night. Local media reports say some senior judges were among those let go. Makuei could not explain why the judges were sacked at the time when the government is expected to address citizen grievances in a national dialogue. Khalid Abdallah Mohammed, chairman of the Judges and Justices Committee, confirmed to South Sudan in Focus that he and several other judges were dismissed but declined to elaborate. Repeated phone calls made to the office of the president were not answered. South Sudanese legal expert Modi Ezekiel says the move undermines the independence of the country's judiciary system.
The judges may not feel free to utter out their views because they fear the executive will sack them. So they will be working according to the wills of the executive. Yet an independent judiciary is very crucial for any country that wants to build a better future.
Ezekiel says, like many others, he was surprised by the president's decision to fire the judges, especially at a time when the judiciary is extremely understaffed. He says sacking the judges will increase the workload on the few remaining judges who are working across the country.
Because first of all, the country has been faced with shortage of judges right from its independence up to now. Some judges died, they were never replaced. Others ran out of the country due to the insecurity. They have never been replaced. While the young generation are not willing to join the judiciary because of the low pay. The decision also has serious implication for the government because the government has to train new judges, which is so costly.
Ezekiel says the notion of firing judges should first have been addressed by the South Sudan's Judicial Service Commission. The judges' strike began on May 1st after the government failed to address their grievances. Besides calling on the government to increase their pay and improve their working conditions, they asked President Kiir to sack Chief Justice Chanarich Madut, who the judges said was not responding to their concerns. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND, says its jailed leader, Hakainde Hichilema, has been transferred to a maximum security prison in Kabwe, the country's second largest city, in defiance of a court order that he be remanded at the Lusaka Central Prison. Hichilema is facing treason charges after his convoy refused to give way to President Lungu's motorcade earlier this year. UPND spokesman Charles Kakoma says Hichilema was removed from the central prison without the knowledge of his family and lawyers.
The opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema was taken from Lusaka prison where he was being held by court order, and he was taken to the maximum prison outside Lusaka in Kabwe without the knowledge of his family and his lawyers. Later on, was again transferred to another prison outside Kabwe to the Kolobos province, where he was taken for a court hearing which he was not aware of and his lawyers were not made aware of.
Did your lawyers find out why he was being transferred to the maximum prison?
We have no idea why he was taken to a maximum prison. And what is worrying people is that maximum prison is associated with people that are waiting for maximum sentence of hanging. But Hakainde Hichilema has not even been tried, has not been convicted, and sentenced to a death sentence. We do not understand why the government is insisting that he must be kept there.
You said your party is concerned the fact that Mr. Hichilema has not had food since Wednesday. Is that true?
Yes. We do not know why he's been kept there or why he has been taken there. In fact, it is guesswork as of now where his whereabouts are. His lawyers don't know where he is. His family don't know where he is. As of now, as we speak, the last time that the family knew that he was at Lusaka prison, and when they went there to take food to him, they were told he's no longer there.
And for the past 2 days as we speak, Mr. Isilema has not had food or water, because the food and water is taken to him by the family. Well, the family don't know where he is now.
Earlier this week, Mr. Hichilema said that he was available, or he offered unconditional dialogue. What do you think is happening?
As far as we know, the government has said that they are not interested in dialogue. And the Republican president has said he doesn't know the agenda for such dialogue.
Do you plan to make an appeal to the court or to the government about the whereabouts of Mr. Hichilema?
Officially, we don't know where Hichilema is being held, but we are just reading on social media that he has been taken to a maximum prison. But the government officially has not made any announcement as to his official whereabouts.
Charles Kakoma is spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you too, James. We begin with the much-anticipated IWAF World Under-18 Championships, which got underway in Nairobi on Wednesday. More than 1,400 athletes from 130 countries are participating in the championships, which ends on Sunday. The IWAF president, Sebastian Coe, was impressed with the work as he paid glowing tributes to the local organizing committee.
I'm a very big admirer of everything that Kenya has achieved in athletics, so I'm delighted that we are here for the first World Athletics Championships in Africa.
In basketball, Egypt, Mali, Algeria, and Mozambique all opened their FIBA Under-16 African Championship 2017 campaign with convincing wins on Thursday at the Phoenix Gymnasium in Mauritius. Reigning champions Egypt recorded the day's largest win, trouncing Madagascar 117-63, led by Seriman Konate and Omar Balo, who combined for 41 Mali points. The West Africans sealed 61-40 triumph over Tunisia. In the second encounter of the day, Algeria, who claimed a third-place finish 2 years ago, had no troubles to overcome Rwanda 61-39. Meanwhile, host Mauritius had a tough continental debut as Alexandra Wong and teammates suffered a resounding 94-28 defeat to Mozambique. In cricket news, the South African national cricket team, the Proteas, will need to draw on their experiences in previous difficult situations to bounce back in the second test against England, starting at the Trent Bridge in Nottingham later today. Captain Fiv du Plessis says the match will be a big character test given some of the off and on field challenges the squad has faced this week.
There was a lot of test for us as a team, and we stood up to that. So it's just about knowing that we can do it and going to this next game and do it.
In football news, one of Ghana's biggest football club, Ashanti Kotoko, was involved in an accident that claimed the life of one person on their delegation, leaving several players and officials needing hospital treatment. The bus carrying the Kumasi-based club were returning home from a Ghana Premier League game against Inter Alias in Accra when their bus struck a stationary vehicle.
I was on the third seat, so what I heard was our assistant coach, that is Gordon Ablode, was shouting on top of his voice, crying for help. So, that was when I realized that we had an accident.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.